Welcome to SCOTUScast. On June 25, 2008, the Supreme Court decided Exxon v. Baker, a case involving the legality under federal maritime law of the $2.5 billion punitive damages award resulting from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. The court considered three questions: whether a ship owner may be liable for punitive damages without acquiescence in the actions causing harm, whether punitive damages have been barred implicitly by federal statutory law making no provision for them, and whether the award of $2.5 billion in this case is greater than maritime law should allow in the circumstances. The court was equally divided on the owner's derivative liability and held that the Federal Clean Water Act does not bar a punitive award on top of damages for economic loss, but that as a matter of maritime common law, the award here should be limited to an amount equal to compensatory damages. Ted Frank, resident fellow and director of the AEI Legal Center for Public Interest, discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Frank.
Hi, I'm Ted Frank of the American Enterprise Institute, talking for the Federalist Society about Exxon Shipping versus Baker, decided this June in the Supreme Court. The case arises from the March 24, 1989 oil spill in Prince William Sound, Alaska. Captain Hazelwood, against Exxon policy, left the bridge of the Exxon Valdez. He left instructions to an unlicensed third mate to make a turn, but those, for some reason, were not obeyed. The ship ran aground on Bly Island Reef 47 minutes later, and 258,000 barrels of oil spilled into a productive fishery. The record of the case is filled with disputes over whether Hazelwood was drunk. He had been acquitted by a jury of criminal charges, but a disputed blood alcohol test did show alcohol in his system. About what Exxon knew about Hazelwood's drinking, he'd previously been treated by Alcoholics Anonymous, and just how the turn was missed while Hazelwood was away from the bridge. Exxon spent billions of dollars in cleanup, $2.1 billion. This is in 1989, so it was double Exxon's annual profits in the United States at the time. It also provided $303 million in voluntary settlements to fishermen, often without a release, $100 million in restitution, a $25 million criminal fine, and $900 million to the state of Alaska. In the criminal case, the United States and Alaska agreed that the amount of the settlement penalty was, quote, sufficient to provide punishment and deterrence for the conduct in question. Nevertheless, in 1994, civil plaintiffs brought a civil action for additional damages, compensatory and punitive. The compensatory damages claims ranged everything from the obvious economic damages to more remote claims such as an eventually rejected $800 million claim for the reduced price of salmon. But the eventual class of $32,000 in a punitive damages class that Exxon requested includes fishermen who lived 1,000 miles away from the spill. Compensatory damages were awarded of $20.3 million in addition to the hundreds of million already paid out by Exxon. And then the question came about what punitive damages should be. The judge instructed the jury that a corporation is responsible for the reckless acts of those employees that are employed in the managerial capacity while acting in the scope of their employment, and that such recklessness is imputed to the corporation. Exxon obviously objected to such a broad instruction of a finding of recklessness. The court charged the jury to consider reprehensibility, financial condition of the defendants, the magnitude of the harm, and any mitigating facts. The jury came back with a $5,000 punitive damages award against Captain Hazelwood and $5 billion against Exxon. This went back and forth from the Ninth Circuit for some time. The Ninth Circuit upheld the disputed jury instruction over recklessness, but after two remands over the punitive damages based on a variety of constitutional decisions coming from the Supreme Court at this time, it eventually reduced punitives to $2.5 billion on its own. Exxon challenged the constitutionality of this award in its appeal, but the Supreme Court limited its review to the legality of the award under United States maritime law. Those in the punitive damages class had also filed their own appeal to the court, seeking to revive the full $5 billion punitive verdict, but the court refused certiorari on that question. Justice Alito recused himself because he owned Exxon stock. This raises the issue of recusals. When there are only eight justices on the court deciding a case, there's the possibility of a 4-4 tie, and a 4-4 tie will... I was interrupted again, and I'll start over again on that paragraph. Justice Alito recused himself because he owned Exxon stock. This left eight justices sitting on the court, and the issue of what happens when there's a 4-4 tie. In a 4-4 tie, it's an equally divided court. There's no decision, and the lower decision is upheld without precedent. This raises obvious problems of unfairness to the petitioner, because you need a five-justice majority, so any justice who accuses himself or herself is effectively the same as a vote for the respondent without actually deciding on the matter. Three times this term, court decisions were affected because of justices' individual stock ownership, including one case where the court couldn't even get a quorum to decide whether to grant cert on a very important Second Circuit decision on the Alien Tort Claims Act. And one of those three times was in the Exxon case. The justices split 4-4 on the question of the appropriateness of the jury instructions and whether Exxon could have the recklessness of its ship's captain violating Exxon policy imputed to it. So that decision was of the Ninth Circuit was effectively upheld by an equally divided court without a precedential decision. So that left the question of the scope of the penalties. Exxon first argued that the penalties were preempted by the Clean Water Act, preventing punitive damages in civil suits. The court rejected this proposition unanimously, though it disagreed with the Ninth Circuit's reasoning. Exxon's argument suffered from some obvious legal contradictions. For one thing, Exxon acknowledged that compensatory damages were not preempted by the Act, leaving a somewhat untenable legal argument that the punitive damages were preempted while the compensatories weren't. The court disposed of that fairly quickly. But it did find a more sympathetic audience to the idea that the $2.5 billion punitive damages decision was excessive. Since the case arose under original federal jurisdiction of maritime law, the court could review the punitive damages under federal common law without getting into the constitutional quandaries. Justice Souter, writing for a five-justice majority, consisting of himself, Roberts, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, noted the, quote, stark unpredictability of punitive damages, which are intended to punish and deter. Fairness, the court noted, requires consistency. Mean punitive damages awards are substantially higher than the median award, which in turn is less than two-thirds of compensatory damages, and there's tremendous variance. The court noted the lack of evidence of internal consistency where like cases are treated alike. Drawing from such cases as Coons versus United States in the criminal context, the court noted that a penalty should be reasonably predictable and that disparities are to be avoided to achieve the goals of the Holmesian bad man theory of the law. What would the bad man know to do or not do? The court then turned to how best to avoid these disparities in the punitive context. It rejected simply relying upon a vague verbal formulation or jury instructions. As the court noted, history has shown that lower courts and juries have not been able to apply these guidelines fairly or consistently to prevent outliers. Therefore, the court concluded, a quantitative approach is needed. One possibility would be caps, just simply capping the amount of punitive damages. The court said that that might be appropriate when the legislature is doing it, but in the common law context would be too inflexible. Individual cases might need individual determinations, and then there's the possibility of inflation, where a cap imposed in 1 year becomes absurdly low decades down the line. After analyzing a variety of possible ratios where punitives would be tied to compensatory damages, the court held that a one-to-one punitive to compensatory damages ratio was most appropriate in a case such as that before it in Exxon, where compensatory damages were already substantial, and there was no evidence that the defendant was trying to injure people or was trying to seek profit through his behavior. Justice Stevens, Ginsburg, and Breyer each filed dissents. Stevens argued that going beyond the constitutional limits was unnecessary because the question of the appropriate scope of punitive damages under the common law was for Congress to decide rather than the judiciary. This expression of judicial restraint is rather unique to Justice Stevens, who just earlier this term dissented in the Stoneridge case, where he argued that the courts had a duty to create remedies where Congress had rejected them. And, of course, as the majority noted, the very idea of compensatory damages for a purely economic injury, as awarded in the Exxon case in the maritime context, was one that had been created by the courts, not by Congress. Justice Ginsburg dissented, disagreeing with the idea of courts limiting punitive damages at all, and noted that the court would have problems deciding limits in other cases where the limiting facts of Exxon did not apply. Justice Breyer, who had expressed some skepticism about the size of the award in oral argument, also ended up dissenting, arguing that Exxon's behavior was sufficiently egregious that the $2.5 billion in punitive damages that the lower court applied were appropriate. The majority opinion suggested that the one-to-one ratio may be of constitutional import, but it's worth noting that Scalia and Thomas wrote a one-paragraph concurrence stating that they continue to hold to their dissent rejecting State Farm and other punitive damages constitutional decisions. There thus do not appear to be five justices who would support a broader application of the Exxon rule to state cases, but the opinion may have some persuasive effect with certain state courts that are inclined to look skeptically upon gigantic punitive damages awards. But then again, one can count on trial attorneys finding ways to argue that the quote-unquote egregious behavior that they're seeking to punish was really undertaken for profit and that the Exxon one-to-one ratio should not apply. Indeed, I suspect and worry that we may find courts misusing the Exxon rule as a floor, that punitive damages should be higher than one-to-one because the conduct is quote-unquote worse than Exxon's, rather than as a ceiling as used in this case. Other courts have certainly misused Gore and State Farm's preference for a ratio of single-digit damages, just simply consistently applied a 9-to-1 ratio. We will know more when the Philip Morris versus Williams punitive damages case goes before the court next term for the third time. There, the ratio is 83-to-1, and we'll see what the court does with that in the smoking case. Also interesting, and of note, in footnote 17, the court looked at empirical experimental evidence conducted by Professor Sunstein and others about juries' application of punitive damages, and the court said that they would not consider that evidence because it was funded in part by Exxon. One hopes that this was just carelessly worded dicta, meant in the narrowest sense that the evidence against punitive damages was sufficiently strong, even without considering the Sunstein studies, rather than simply an ad hominem attack on those studies. They gave no reason, no methodological reasons to reject those studies, but we can certainly expect to see others using footnote 17 to make arguments against rejecting other sort of Brandeis briefs and the use of social science research where the funding is at issue. And if so, one hopes that courts apply the rule consistently and also reject trial lawyer-funded legal research. Finally, we should return to the recusal issue. Justices have life tenure and generous pensions, and in an age where cheap index funds are available, there's really very little excuse for justices to hold individual stocks that will require recusal in cases that have just gigantic implications for the nation's economy as a whole. Congress had, a couple of years ago, at the behest of Chief Justice Roberts, passed a law permitting justices to sell their stocks without incurring capital gains taxes. But justices have not consistently taken advantage of that law, and perhaps stronger measures are needed to examine what justices are holding and whether they should be holding individual stocks at all. I'm Ted Frank for the Federalist Society.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.